Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now we continue our 30 Issues election series, Issue 28, So Many Ways to Disenfranchise Voters. Yesterday, we played some historical audio with examples of some of the ways that potential voters have been disenfranchised. We heard Martin Luther King talk about biased literacy tests. We heard Sonia Sotomayor talk about moving polling places into areas with a history of voter intimidation, and more examples. Today, we'll focus on the disenfranchisement battles taking place right now in this year's presidential race, made more intense by the Supreme Court weakening the Voting Rights Act in 2013. So this is the first presidential election where that new weakened law applies. One major battleground is the crucial swing state of North Carolina, which passed a restrictive new voting law recently struck down in federal court. U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch supported the court's ruling. Here's why.
It targeted African Americans, as the court noted, with almost surgical precision, imposing stringent ID requirements, reducing same-day registration, and constraining out-of-precinct voting to place barriers between citizens and the ballot box.
Attorney General Lynch. But North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory feels his state is being unfairly singled out as trying to disenfranchise black Americans by reducing the number of early voting days.
The critics are kind of using that line when, in fact, the legislation does not shorten the hours for early voting. And by the way, states like New York have no early voting. So it's kind of ironic that Eric Holder is suing us and not suing the state of New York.
As for the candidates, you know by now that Donald Trump's current campaign rhetoric is emphasizing the specter of widespread voter fraud, despite it being practically non-existent in this country in modern times. In that context, he argues for laws that require the presentation of state-issued photo ID cards before anyone can vote.
What's with voter ID? Why aren't we having voter ID? In other words, I want to vote. Here's my identification. I want to vote, as opposed to somebody coming up and voting 15 times for Hillary.
Just this summer, a federal appeals court struck down one of the strictest photo ID laws in the country, the one in Texas, which the court found was crafted to target minority voters who would tend to have greater barriers to getting state-issued IDs without offering them a remedy for doing so. That law was originally signed in 2011 by then-Texas Governor Rick Perry, as Hillary Clinton noted, speaking in the state in 2014.
But Governor Perry is hardly alone in his crusade against voting rights. In Wisconsin, Governor Scott Walker cut back early voting and signed legislation that would make it harder for college students to vote. In New Jersey, Governor Chris Christie vetoed legislation to extend early voting. And in Florida, when Jeb Bush was governor, state authorities conducted a deeply flawed purge of voters before the presidential election in 2000.
And Florida is back in the disenfranchised headlines again. Maybe you haven't heard this, but Hurricane Matthew hit at the same time as the deadline for registering to vote in Florida. But Republican Governor Rick Scott refused requests to extend the deadline to compensate.
We've had plenty of time to register. Look, this is politics. I mean, I'm focused on getting this done. I'm focused on saving everybody's life. The biggest issue for me is I want everybody to survive this.
In the end, a court ordered the registration deadline extended for 6 days because of the storm over the governor's objection. With me for a little more campaign analysis on this is Ari Berman, author of the new book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Ari, welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian, thank you for having me.
Let me start right there on that little dust-up after the hurricane in Florida this month. Did that seem emblematic to you of a bigger push and pull?
it did seem emblematic to me. You'd think that it would be common sense that if people have to evacuate their homes and their counties, that you'd give them a little bit more time to register to vote. Rick Scott in Florida was basically saying to people, leave your homes, but by the way, I'm not going to give you an opportunity to register before the deadline closes. So common sense would dictate that they would have just extended the deadline, but they didn't do that. And I think it was viewed as another attempt by Republicans to try to put up more roadblocks to voting, because if you look at the data in Florida, many, many, many more Democrats have been registered this election cycle than Republicans. So it was viewed as if they extended the deadline, it was going to help Democrats, as opposed to just common sense, extend the deadline and give people more time to participate.
Our frame here is so many ways to disenfranchise voters, and we listed various ones that have taken place over time yesterday that I just referred to, and some more here in that little tape essay that I just did. There was one that Hillary Clinton referred to that I wasn't familiar with, an attempt in, I think it was Wisconsin, to make it harder for college students to vote. Do you happen to be familiar with that?
I am familiar with it. So the way that Wisconsin wrote their voter ID law, most IDs from universities and colleges were not accepted, which was very curious because the whole point of the voter ID law was to require government-issued IDs to vote. Well, University of Wisconsin IDs, for example, are government-issued IDs. Those are state universities. But they wrote the law in such a way, the legislature wrote the law in such a way that those IDs wouldn't count because they didn't have proper expiration dates. They lasted 2 years, and they said they had to be for 2 years instead of 4 years, which makes no sense. And so basically, students across Wisconsin had to get completely separate IDs just to be able to vote. And I was in Wisconsin for the primary, and it was very confusing to students at places like Marquette, at places like University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, that they couldn't use their student IDs. They had to get completely separate IDs just to be able to vote that they didn't need for any other purpose in their life.
Another college-oriented one that I mentioned yesterday was in New Hampshire a few years ago. There was an attempt in the legislature that failed. Of course, New Hampshire is a swing state, so this is why they were pushing it, that students whose parents lived in another state could not vote in New Hampshire, but it didn't get through.
And we've seen that in other states, too. In North Carolina, for example, there was proposed legislation that said that if you voted where you go to school as opposed to where your parents live, you could be taxed up to $2,500, which is completely insane. And we should mention that this is also unconstitutional. The Supreme Court has clearly said that students have a right to vote where they go to school, that that is their residency for the purpose of voting. And I think it's really outrageous that people who are voting in many cases for the first times in their life and are not familiar with this process are suddenly facing all of these artificial barriers.
What's your take on the whole voter ID debate? Of all these restrictions, it's the one that I think makes the most common sense to many people, which is why it's the most politically successful. You need a real ID to vote to prevent fraud, even if voter identity fraud today is almost non-existent. Why isn't it just common sense that you need to clearly identify yourself and a photo ID issued by the state is the standard?
Well, I wouldn't have a problem with voter ID laws if everyone had the ID that was required, but that's clearly not the case. You look at a place like Texas, for example, where their voter ID law has been struck down repeatedly by the courts. The courts found that 600,000 registered voters in Texas, which is 5% of the electorate, did not have strict forms of photo ID, that blacks and Hispanics in Texas were 2 to 3 times as likely to not have IDs, and not just did they not have IDs, but they had trouble getting access to them. So, for example, a third of counties in Texas don't even have a DMV office. So if you don't have a driver's license, Texas is not like New York City, as you know, Brian. If you live in a rural county in Texas and you don't drive, you don't have a driver's license, you don't have a DMV in your county, how are you supposed to get to an adjoining rural county that could be up to 100 miles away just to get this ID that you need? And so that's why the courts, both Republican and democratically appointed judges, have found that this was unconstitutional, this discriminated against blacks and Latinos, and that there are other ways to verify the integrity of who the person are. That, for example, in Texas, when you could vote with your voter registration card, there was no widespread voter fraud in the state. This was about politics, not about fraud, because Texas only presented 2 cases of voter impersonation in court over the past decade to try to justify the law, which is very, very little evidence. And the law was written in such a way for example, to allow IDs like a handgun permit, but not allow student IDs. So it clearly seemed like it was targeting some communities over others.
We talked on the show yesterday about the 2013 Supreme Court ruling that struck down the heart of the Voting Rights Act, the requirement that states like Texas, with a history of ballot discrimination, get pre-clearance from the U.S. Justice Department for any voting law changes. Texas then went right for the changes that Hillary Clinton criticized in that clip of her. But a court did strike that law down, and a court did halt the restrictive North Carolina law. Is that an indication that maybe the Supreme Court didn't do much damage because the federal courts are still capable and proving themselves capable of defending voting rights on a case-by-case basis?
No, I don't think that's right, because the decision has done a tremendous amount of damage. Only some laws, only the most egregious laws, have been blocked in the case of North Carolina. Texas's voter ID law is still in effect, by the way, but on a more relaxed basis. So you don't have to show strict photo ID, but you still have to show some forms of ID, and you have to be able to sign an affidavit if you don't have strict forms of ID. So that law could still lead to a lot of confusion. But I think the difference here is that these laws were blocked ahead of time under the Voting Rights Act before it was gutted. And states had the burden of showing that their laws were not discriminatory. Now the burden has been shifted to those that are facing discrimination. These are incredibly expensive lawsuits. They take a tremendous amount of time. And you have a situation where people are disenfranchised in the meantime. So in Texas in 2014, in North Carolina in 2014, when these laws were in effect, as they were working their way through the courts, people were disenfranchised. I documented, and a group called Democracy North Carolina documented, 2,300 cases in North Carolina of people who were turned away from the polls. And that's a very large number in a close election. And so I think that the courts are having some success in terms of pushing back on the worst of these restrictions, but it's much, much, much more difficult than it was before. And voters do not have the protections that they previously had under the Voting Rights Act.
On the issue of the rigged election, so much in the news now because of the candidate, the response from all responsible quarters is that there have been many studies and there just is almost no voter identity fraud that ever takes place in the United States. And yet there were some historical episodes like the one in Chicago decades ago that's always used with the jokey slogan, vote early, vote often. If it existed then, why couldn't it exist now without modern safeguards like voter ID?
Well, I think what we find is that anytime you have a conspiracy that's large enough to actually try to swing an election, that usually means it's going to get caught. Because if you go to try to impersonate one voter, if I go and show up multiple times and say I'm Brian Lehrer, well, first off, you're a pretty well-known guy, so that might not work. But secondly, if I do it more than once, I'm probably going to get caught. And then I'm only going to swing one, two, three extra votes.
So, but that's not the way it works, that you vote as the same person in different locations. I imagine it's you go to different locations and vote as different people who might be registered but dead, as Trump pointed out.
Let's just say that you try to do this in New York, which doesn't have strict ID, where you just have to sign your name and provide your address. You would still have to know the person's signature that you're trying to impersonate, the person's name, the person's address, the person's polling place, the person's precinct. And by the way, you'd have to know that that person hasn't already voted. And so when you hear claims, that's just an impossible scenario. And when you hear claims like Trump saying, well, 1.8 million dead people are voting, that's just because the voting rules have not been updated. Those people are not actually voting. And so you hear these headlines, but you actually have to dig deeper. And the Kansas Secretary of State, Chris Kobach, who is a major Trump supporter, held this press conference and he said, well, dead people are voting in Kansas. And he singled out a guy named Alfred K. Brewer. And he said, this man, Alfred K. Brewer, is deceased and he's voting. Well, the Wichita Eagle did some follow-up reporting and they went to Alfred K. Brewer's house, and they found him raking leaves on his front yard. And he said, I don't think I'm in heaven, not when I'm here raking leaves. And so the point is, you hear these headlines, but you have to actually investigate the facts. And we're not seeing things like dead people voting in mass any longer in American elections.
Stories of his demise greatly exaggerated. Just to finish up, Ari, in the clip we played of North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory, he asked, why isn't the federal government suing states like New York that have no early voting rather than a state like North Carolina that just reduced the number of days? Does he have a point?
Well, I think the issue is that you can't have something like early voting and then take it away. So the federal government can't force New York to have early voting, but in states that had early voting, they could say, why did you cut it? And so I would love for New York to have early voting. I think our election laws in this state are absolutely shameful. At the same time, North Carolinians have no idea what the election laws are in New York. They only know what's going on in their own state. And when you cut early voting, when you eliminate same-day voter registration, these are very burdensome things in North Carolina. And that's why the court found that this was discriminatory, that in North Carolina in particular, African Americans voted 70% early compared to half of white voters who used early voting. So there clearly was a disproportionate impact there. The state of North Carolina admitted that counties that had a larger African American population and tended to vote Democratic used early voting in higher numbers. And that's why the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals said that this was a smoking gun.
In your opinion, looking forward, should early voting and same-day registration become basic voting rights nationally?
I think they should. I would like to see every state make it easier to register voters, have a longer period of time to be able to vote. I think that would lead to fewer problems on Election Day. It would make it more convenient. More people would participate. I would love to see New York become a leader in voting rights as opposed to a state that's at the bottom of every voting indicator. However, I don't think that excuses a state like North Carolina from disenfranchising voters either.
Ari Berman, you may know him from The Nation magazine, and is the author of the book Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Ari, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Brian.
And that's today's installment of our 30 Issues election series, Issue 28, So Many Ways to Disenfranchise People. More on Issue 28 tomorrow. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. A lot more to come today. Stay with us.